This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Welcome back to the Financial Sense News Hour and a special edition of The Big Picture. Jim Poplava and John Loeffler here with you. You know, history is replete with numerous examples of manias and financial bubbles. Most people will cite the tulip craze that existed at one time, which of course burst, the South Sea bubble, the Mississippi scheme, as it is called, and of course, the recent high-tech bubble and the real estate and mortgage bubbles, which all went kapop back in 2007, 2008. Now, we have a tremendous record of human folly. It goes back quite a ways. I remember the old adage that he who fails to understand history is condemned to repeat it. Why do we never learn to repeat the same mistakes? Because the first lesson history teaches, if we're going to see what lessons history teach, is that most people don't learn the lessons of history. But, you know, today you can push a button and get almost any information you want relatively instantaneously, depending on whether or not the internet's cooperating with you. But we do. We live in a high-tech society, and we have more information available at our fingertips than any time in history, and even than 15 years ago, if you realize this, how fast this information age is growing. So why do we keep making the same mistakes? It's incredibly predictable, and maybe it says something about the nature of humankind as well, that they always seem to go back and repeat the same mistakes. So what we're going to do, we have a special program today. We're going to take you deep inside the anatomy of a bubble. And here's a warning, there is one forming right now, and that will be the subject of conversation.
And, you know, before we begin this deep dive that we're going to do today, I want to recommend two books. They're very popular. They're classics. One is called Extraordinary Popular Delusions in the Madness of Crowds, and it was written by an attorney, Charles McKay, in the 19th century. It's got a foreword in the most printable edition by Bernard Baruch, a financier, well-known right around the great financial crash and the Great Depression. But McKay basically wrote about some of the things you just talked about, John. He wrote about the tulip mania, which was featured in Wall Street 2. And then also he talked about the South Sea scandal, the South Sea bubble, and the Mississippi scheme. And we've had various bubbles throughout history. Now, more recently, there was a professor, Charles Kindleberger, who wrote a book called Manias, Panics, and Crashes, The History of Financial Crises. And it is two of the most well-written books that have been out there. It's just absolutely must reading. If you want to understand these very questions that we're going to try to ask today, why do these bubbles occur? In other words, right after the internet bubble, we went right into the real estate and mortgage bubble. And we're entering a stock market bubble in a way that you've never seen it done before. And we'll get more into that later on in the program. But both books do a good job of sort of documenting these bubbles in some of the common characteristics. As you mentioned, John, those who fail to learn from history are doomed to repeat it. So that is what we are going to cover today. We're going to talk about the anatomy of a bubble. How do they form? What do they look like? Is there a familiar pattern? And where is that bubble forming today?
What I'd like to do then here, first of all, let's get into the anatomy of a bubble. I know you believe that there is one forming in the market, but before we do that, let's go to the mechanics of bubbles, and then we'll see how this newly forming bubble will probably follow the same pattern.
Well, I mean, the first aspect you have to understand is that much of the financial world that exists today is built around the theories of what we call rational financial human behavior. And one of the most prominent, if you're going through a financial program, you're taught a course in finance, stock investing, you're going through the CFA program, is the efficient market hypothesis. And that basically is saying that you can't beat the market, that anything that's out there on the market already knows that, and it is reflected in the price of everything. And the main thesis behind it is that the markets are rational, and hence human behavior is rational, which has been proven that it isn't. Otherwise, why do you have financial bubbles? if markets are acting rational and individuals which make up the market are acting rational, how do we have an internet bubble? And the best example of that is what occurred in the late 90s when everybody thought we were living in the new economy. And the internet bubble burst between 2000 and 2002, and in 2002 to 2007, we were back in the formation of another bubble. This time, it was real estate. So, and now we have what's going on with the FANG stocks, and the latest bubble, or the new bubble, is what I call index investing. And we'll get more into that and show you why it's creating a bubble in the markets. And later on, we'll get into specifics on how to identify it and the risk that is out there today, because it's all become the rage of investing.
The one common characteristic, I guess, if you look at any of these bubbles, is that as soon as the general populace discovers what's going on, there's a euphoria that kicks in, and they believe it's the road to quick riches. Everybody's doing it. You can't lose. That's sort of the mantra that we hear every single time.
Yeah. And for bubbles to take place, what you usually see repeated throughout history is suddenly the whole community suddenly becomes fixated upon one object and they go mad in pursuit, whether it's tulip mania, tulips in the 16th century, or internet stocks in the 90s, or real estate in the last decade. The thing is, millions of people become simultaneously impressed with one illusion, which develops into a delusion, and run after it until some kind of shock or something, it bursts the bubble and their attention is caught up by some new folly that captivates them afterwards. And you saw this happen very quickly within a very short period of time, because we had the internet bubble and technology stocks, which lasted between 95 and the year 2000. And of course, that burst in March of 2000 when the NASDAQ fell apart and lost 70% of its value. And by the way, it would take tech stocks almost 13 years and the S&P 13 years to regain the former high reached in March of 2000. But right after the bursting of the tech bubble, what did we get next? We got the real estate bubble and the mortgage bubble. Everybody, well, you were going to make a fortune in the internet and technology, and then it quickly made and transferred to everybody was going to make a fortune in real estate. I can remember writing about it in the day after tomorrow. We were seeing housing developments. Fortune magazine talked about some of these young people that are going around to different housing developments, buying 10, 15 homes on speculation, ninja loans. Banks were loaning money freely. You didn't even have to qualify. We used to call them liar loans. And all of a sudden, but the important thing is there's a concept that has to grab the imagination. It can be technology in the case of the internet, or real estate, like an asset class that you just can't lose money. I mean, even our own Fed chairman, in the right as the bubble was bursting in 2007, was interviewed on CNBC by Maria Bartiromo and asked about real estate. He said, real estate is doing fine. You know, we've never had a problem with real estate. As real estate was rolling over, prices were getting ready to crash, and the great financial crisis was directly ahead of us.
Feeling like bubbles. They're fragile. It's like these tulips. This is the greatest bubble story of all time. Back in the 1600s, the Dutch, they get speculation fever to the point that you could buy a beautiful house on a canal in Amsterdam for the price of one bulb. They called it tulip mania. Then it collapsed. You buy 10 bulbs for $2. People got wiped out, but, you know, who remembers?
That was the voice of Michael Douglas in the role of Gordon Gekko. Most people remember those movies. And here he is talking about the tulip bubble, which we mentioned here on the program, but he's also talking about the psychology of what happens when these things kick into force.
Yeah, what helps to create a bubble is the prospect of imaginary wealth. The public becomes infatuated with the idea that promises vast and easy money. And the other thing that goes along with it, it becomes widely publicized. And you see people making fabulous sums of money. And of course, publicity reinforces the illusion. I mean, think back of what was going on in the 90s. I can remember turning on the television every day. Boy, was the media reinforcing. We were in a new age. The business cycle had been repeated. in the front cover of Time magazine talking about Greenspan and Sumner's in Rubin is the Committee to Save the World. We had repealed it, and technology was going to lead us, and we were all going to get rich. The savings rate dropped down to zero. Why would you save when you can make 15% a year in the stock market? Because we were all going to get wealthy. And it was fed by the media. And boy, did they do a good job of feeding it each day. I can remember watching some of the cable television when the Dow first crossed 10,000. They were wearing tuxedos and champagne. And then we saw it once again after the bursting of the tech bubble starting in 2002. Well, people were making money in real estate. They were flipping real estate. And the lenders just got absolutely crazy. Just as Chuck Prince at Citigroup said, when the music's playing, we got to stay on the dance floor and dance. And everybody was dancing, thinking they were going to make a fortune in real estate. Magazines, shows, flipping real estate, no money down. I mean, nobody ever lost money in real estate. And so everybody began to believe it. And you were seeing the value of homes go up at rates we'd never seen before, just as we're seeing that in California today, especially Northern California around Silicon Valley, where the prices of homes are selling for over $1,000 a square foot, if not more. And you saw it in the late 90s. People quit their jobs. People fired their advisors. Why would you need an advisor? Why would you need a job? You could just day trade. And there were basically businesses that formed here. There were a couple here in California that had what we call day trading centers, where you could lease space, have access through the internet, and you would have some kind of trading program, and you could just trade internet stocks. I mean, people were making money, and it was being pumped each day. You had internet IPOs with companies that had no sales. You know, initially they had sales and a concept like Amazon. When it went public, they actually did have sales. They were selling books and tapes on the internet. But towards the end, you had companies that had no sales at all, and they would go public as an IPO, and they would double or triple in their first day. And that's what you see today. The same thing is going on with index funds and index ETFs. The epicenter of what I believe is the new bubble that it's in. It's about to enter into its final stage.
As you say, Jim, behind every single bubble always seems to be some kind of an event, an idea, a concept, or a technology that for some reason starts to capture everybody's attention. It's the new and greatest thing. The sky's the limit. Can't you see? This is the future. It's what we hear.
I bought it 10 years ago for $60,000. I could sell it today for $600. The illusion has become real. And the more real it becomes, the more desperate they want it. Capitalism at its finest.
Now, there's Gordon Gekko again.
I love those two movies. In fact, somebody had to write a book called The Wisdom of Gordon Gekko. But, you know, he's talking about this. You know, it starts out as an idea, then it becomes an illusion. And as it becomes an illusion, the more people want it, the more the flames of speculation and prices going up, it just captures more attention. Nothing captures attention more of investors than rising prices. And the other aspect about bubbles and crises, they always occur, John, and are associated with the peak of the business cycle and a Fed rate raising cycle. Go back to the internet bubble in the years. In fact, one of the best years of the bubble was 1999, when the NASDAQ was up 70% in a single year. If you wanted to make money, there was only one place to be, and that was in technology stocks. And it was not unusual to see mutual funds with 70% of their assets invested in technology. And today it's the same thing. If you want to make money, you have to be in an index fund, either an index mutual fund or an index ETF. And what did you see happen in 1999? Number one, oil prices bottomed in 1998 at $10 a barrel. And from the bottom of 1998 to the beginning of the year 2000, the price of oil went from 10 to almost $35 a barrel. The Fed started raising interest rates in 1999. And by 2001, we were in a recession. What happened again? In the last decade, real estate prices started to go up. The economy started to heat. Oil prices went from $50 a barrel to $150 a barrel. Inflation heated up. The Fed ratcheted rate raising cycle from 2004 to 2007. And what did we get? Another recession and a bear market. So one factor that contributes and feeds the bubble is cheap money and credit. When the prospect of great riches and fast and very easy money is made, what are investors tempted to do? They go out. I mean, if the market's going up 15 to 20%, why not borrow money? I mean, today, even with the Fed funds rate at 1.25%, you can borrow money in the 1% range and put it in the market. You can put it in stocks that pay twice that, or even in bonds that pay more than that. So the other thing that feeds the flames of not only speculation and rising prices is the inclusion or advent of credit that moves into the market. Because my goodness, if you can make 15 to 20%, or in the case of the internet days, double your money in a single day, you would be foolish not to borrow money. And so you saw the increase of leverage. You saw it in the late 90s with margin debt at record levels we had never seen before. And you saw the same thing take place in the last decade with derivatives, credit default swaps, heavily mortgaged real estate. I can remember doing my research for the day after tomorrow, talking to lenders. Why would you want to put any money down? I mean, that's wasted money. Real estate always goes up. Why tie up your money? And so credit is another factor that fuels the bubble besides the mania in the media that feeds it.
Jim, I know a lot of times you talk about the various stages of a bull market, you know, that it goes through three phases. Bubbles go through similar phases as well. Why don't you describe those? You know, we go from this stage to that stage and how everything, and it's very interesting because for the most part, anytime you run into one of these bubbles, they don't skip a stage. It seems to go through every single stage.
Yeah, there's very common characteristics. There was an economist who remained unknown, very well-known, very sharp guy by the name of Hyman Minsky. He was a professor at Washington University and a scholar at the Levy Institute, and he wrote about financial crises and bubbles and documented them large, and much of what he said played out, and you're seeing it play out now. It played out in between 2002 and 2007, and you also saw it play out in the internet bubble. And he outlined various stages in the process. In the first phase, there are events that lead up to the financial crisis and the bursting bubble. But they all start with an idea. Call it tulips, call it real estate, call it technology, call it internet stocks, or call it index investing, which is the bubble that's forming now. And it captures everybody's attention. And it's this idea and the imagination that becomes the illusion that promises investors vast sums of easy money. The other thing that also goes along with it is leverage that comes into the system, and the banking system gets involved because there's a spread between low interest rates and what it costs to borrow, which encourages banks to make lending money. And when asset values are rising, bankers are saying, well, this is a good investment. I have money that I can make on the spread between what I pay my depositors, which is nothing, which is what happened towards the end of the internet bubble and also happened in the real estate bubble when the Fed funds rate got down to 1%, or more recently during the financial crisis when the Fed funds rate got down to 0.25%. And when asset values are rising, banks feel very good. If they loan you, as they did in real estate, 100% on a value of a piece of property, why wouldn't they? Real estate prices were going up 15% a year. So if I loan you 100% on your home, let's say you're buying a $100,000 home. Let's just keep the illustration simple. And I'm going to loan you $100,000 as a bank. The reason I'm doing it is I think that house, which is worth $100,000 a year from now, will be worth $115,000 the year after, $130,000. So I have collateral to back that loan, and they forget what happens when prices collapse. And that's exactly what we saw leverage come into the system in the tech bubble between 1997 and 2000. Just look at a graph, a margin debt. I can remember when you had companies like AOL, when they got included in the S&P 500 index, in 1 month, the price of AOL doubled in 30 days. Amazon, less than 30 days. Amazon, I think, doubled in a period of a week. And then if you think about the real estate market, mortgages and derivatives between 2005 and 2008, there was more money going into credit default swaps, derivatives, mortgages of every kind, because bankers weren't on the hook for this. They made the loan, they packaged it, sold it as a security in some kind of mortgage-backed security, so it was off their books. And so they just kept recycling that money and making new loan after new loan after new loan, because there wasn't any direct link between the actions of the bankers and the assets in which they were loaning money. It was perceived, well, if all of these real estate mortgages were packaged into a mortgage pool, you were more diversified and safer. And it got to the point where they would put low quality loans in and mix them. And the idea was, well, if you have enough low quality loans and you have enough of them, you're diversified. So there's less risk. And so that usually is what happens during the first phase.
All right. Well, when does it become an investment idea? Because if we look at the tech bubble, the countries we were talking about are, you know, Intel, Microsoft, Amazon, it, relatively new businesses. It was a new, whole new field that was opening and booming. It was creating jobs in the economy. But obviously it makes a transition somewhere in there from a good idea, a good investment idea, to speculation. And that's where things seem to kick off.
And that's Minsky's second phase. It's called the euphoria phase, where an investment concept, originally there was probably some fundamental investment idea behind it, whether it's buying real estate or it's buying technology stocks like the Intels, the Microsofts, the Dell computers, which were the front runners of the technology boom, AOL, the internet companies. But then what happens as this gains recognition, then all of a sudden the concept becomes an illusion. And the more illusionary it is, the more people want it. As that clip from Wall Street Week, an investment turns into speculation, and speculation enters the picture. Now, people are speculating. What was once rational becomes irrational, with everyone seeking to become rich. And there's nothing more disturbing to one's personal psyche and well-being and judgment is to see a friend get rich. And when a number of friends, firms, households indulging in this practice grows large, it catches a large swath of the population that is normally aloof or oblivious from such ventures. And speculation then moves away from what is normal and gives way to what becomes irrational behavior. And that's when the bubbles phase, that's when the bubble begins to inflate. And that's when you see prices get divorced completely from the fundamentals of running a business. In the latter stages, prices are completely detached from reality. People want to become rich without understanding the process of becoming rich and the process itself involved. There is no fundamental analysis. I just buy. And that's exactly what people are doing today with index funds. And we'll get into that later on.
There have got to be some stages, Jim, where the smart people realize things have become detached from that reality that you're talking about, you know. And if remember when the tech bubble started to roll, we look back at December of 1999, there was a stock market series. You did your Perfect Storm series too. And basically you were asked to guest on a number of these financial shows and pilloried as some kind of a Luddite who didn't understand new technology. But what you understood was the dynamics of bubbles. And regardless of what the techs were, I remember a guy I work with was that way. It was just like every day he's got these dazzles in his eyes, you know, as this tech market was going up and up and up and up. And that was it. And they cannot see that each of these is a bubble. Each one of them rolls over.
Yeah, it was really interesting because we got involved in technology stocks. And John, I made the, you know, coming from the Ben Graham School value investing in 1995, I got out of my tech stocks and watched with horror in the next 2 years as many of these stocks I had gotten out of got even more inflated. So we got back into the technology market in 97. But in December of 1999, and you remember this, John, Y2K, I know as a firm, we spent more than $60,000 upgrading our computers, our software. It was SEC guided rules. Companies were spending hundreds of millions of dollars for Y2K. But I can remember in December, I was looking at, I can't think of the company. I don't know if it was pets.com. I'm trying to think who it was. It was an internet IPO. The company had no sales. It goes public at a value of $5 billion and it doubles. And the analysts were talking about how many clicks they got on their website. Forget the fact they had zero sales, zero profits, zero money. We were analyzing the company on the basis of internet clicks. And I looked at that and I said, this is absolutely insane. I think it was the second or third week of 1999. We got out of the market. I just said, this is just goofy. I mean, you had, and you know, it's a legitimate company. It's still around and it's a very successful company, Cisco. Cisco had a market valuation of $600 billion. And I think back then their sales were only $20 billion. And it was just absolutely crazy. And we're going to get into some of this crazy stuff now. But in stage three, which is the final stage of the bubble, and I think we're going to enter into one as this year ends and gets into next year, is the bubble and the speculative mania continues. You see a number of things. Number one, interest rates are rising. What are we seeing now? Interest rates are rising. Money velocity starts to increase. Well, we've got to watch that one. And prices continue to mount to the point that we enter a period of unease in financial duress. And all of a sudden, some of the people start to begin to think, man, it might be a good time to get out. I'm up tenfold. You've made a fortune. So there's a gradual move. It starts slowly to get out of the asset bubble and get into cash or money or to get liquid. And it results in severe consequences eventually for asset prices, because as stress levels pick up, and we'll talk about what kind of burst the bubble, you know, there's a realization by people that, gosh, you know, I can't believe the kind of money I'm making. You know, how much higher can prices go? And of course, the media is going to feed that. Well, you have to be open-minded about this, whatever it is, whether it's tulips, whether it's internet stocks or real estate. Well, it's always going to go up because there's such a demand for it. And yeah, you might have paid an idiotic price, but there's another idiot standing behind you that's going to pay you even a higher price for whatever it is that you own. But there becomes that point where somebody starts to think that market prices can't go any higher. And what happens is there's a gradual exit. Eventually, that gradual exit turns into a selling stampede. It's like somebody finally yells fire in the movie theater and everybody tries to get out that one door.
Okay, so at some point, though, everybody's getting uneasy and they start selling. They sort of ease over to the door. Not everybody's doing it, but they start getting out. But invariably, Jim, isn't it some kind of an event or action that ultimately precipitates the stampede? And I'm going to guess the Federal Reserve's involved here.
Yeah, I mean, there's an event that takes place towards the end that leads to a crisis. It's a displacement. It's an exogenous event and shock to the macroeconomic system that accelerates the crisis. It could be, for example, the failure of a bank. Think of Bear Stearns in the Fed rescue operation of merging that into J.P. Morgan. And then think of September of 2008 when the government allowed Lehman Brothers to go under, and then it just became a domino effect. It was Lehman. It was AIG. It was Merrill Lynch. It was one financial institution after another. And that accelerates the process because some of these firms, once again, remember a key ingredient towards a bubble, money and credit. When you can make high returns, there is the greed factor that comes in. Well, if I can borrow at a cheap rate and I can make double digit, triple digit returns on my money, as happened in the internet phase when people are using margin debt, I mean, why not? Companies would go public in a single day and double and be up 100%, sometimes even more in a single day. And so what happens is these institutions got leveraged in the last financial crisis. Lehman Brothers was leveraged 40-1. And so it doesn't take much of a drop in asset prices before the company is financially bankrupt. And usually when that happens, when the financial failures start to erupt, the stampede accelerates. And then that stampede accelerates the prices of decline as people try to get up. There's financial duress and people start thinking of getting out. So everybody is rushing for the exit gates all at once for liquidity to get out of the assets and get into cash and get liquid. And it results in a severe consequence for prices of assets as distress increases the speculators wake up that market prices can't go higher. And then what is gradual selling turns into a stampede. And that's what you saw between 2000 and 2001. And you saw it at the beginning. It began gradually in the fall of 2007. The stock market peaked. It had a good year in 2007. 2008, we began to see the disruption of prices. The Fed continued to raise interest rates. Oil prices went from $100 a barrel at the beginning of the year. We got all the way up to 150. Inflation was running at 5%. And then all of a sudden, it began to crack in the summer of 2008. And by the fall, with the bankruptcy of Lehman, the stampede was in full force. I could remember, God, I used to shudder every Monday morning. Something happened over the weekend, and Secretary of the Treasury Hank Paulson would have a press conference on Monday. Right after he gave a speech, the Dow would be down 500 points because people said, this is really serious. This is dangerous. And these guys don't seem to know what they're doing. And it would change. And that's usually what happens in the final stages, whether it was the financial crisis. And I think the difference, and we'll get into this as we get to our conclusions here, the difference was there was so much debt that had come into the system in the last decade with loose lending standards, the financial reforms that got rid of Glass-Steagall, the Commodities Trading Act that allowed a lot of these firms to get into derivatives and leverage 40-1, the SEC rules that changed. Banks used to be able to leverage 12-1, and then the banks went to the SEC and say, hey, we're at a disadvantage. Our European counterparts are leveraged 40-1. Look how much money they're making. And you got us down to 12-1. So that was lifted. And what happened? Banks like Lehman, Merrill, all of them leveraged to the hilt, which was why in the fall, they had to patch together a $700 billion rescue package to keep these banks solvent because they were insolvent at that point.
So the bubble then goes kerpop. That brings us into the final stage. When the internet bubble burst, then people got out of that and said, oh my gosh, you can get in trouble in the stock market. I don't know anything about stocks. And what they do, they jumped into real estate because, well, nobody ever loses money in real estate. And the next bubble starts, you know, so there doesn't seem to be a learning from the psychology.
No. And at that stage, usually, as we saw Lehman, Bear Stearns, Merrill Lynch, AIG, all these big financial institutions go under, the stampede accelerates, prices decline and rapidly. That's the thing about the bear market is a bull market climbs a gradual step. It takes place over a period of time. The characteristic of bear markets is they happen rapidly. The declines are swift. They're steep. Ever look at a chart of a bear market and you can see what I mean here. It takes place over a short period of time because all of a sudden greed turns to panic, which turns to revulsion. And it's something that, you know, people forswear, I'll never do that again. Well, they're doing it again right now.
Yeah, I guess one of the ironies is that back in 1996, the man who caused the bubble, Alan Greenspan, by creating the liquidity that enabled the tech market to take off. As you've said very, very frequently here, when you create liquidity in terms of currency, it has to go somewhere. Now, the Fed can create it. They can't always control where it's going to go. But what was ironic is that very early on in the whole frenzy, he himself, even though the Fed had caused the situation, talked about the irrational exuberance.
Clearly, sustained low inflation implies less uncertainty about the future, and lower risk premiums imply higher prices of stocks and other earning assets. We can see that in the inverse relationship exhibited by price earnings ratios and the rate of inflation in the past. But how do we know when irrational exuberance has unduly escalated asset values, which then become subject to unexpected and prolonged contractions as they have in Japan over the past decade? And how do we factor that assessment into monetary policy?
There you have it, Alan Greenspan, basically the maestro, the Fed chair at the time, saying that the PE ratios were just a tad high, making reference to a lot of the same things you were seeing back in 1995. But you do get into that final stage, the end of all manias, and one of the more curious phenomena that comes out of that is that prices get so low, finally, they crash to the bottom, it actually attracts dollars back into the sector.
Yeah, because I can remember the market bottomed in March of 2009, and two things happened. The Fed announced the beginning of QE1, $1.2 trillion for 1 year, and then also they ended the mark-to-market accounting for banks' balance sheets. And that began the genesis of the new bull market, which we're still in today, and what I think we're entering our final stage. But how many people wanted to get in? I can remember in 2009 in the summer talking about the market. Nobody wanted to get in the market. We were still talking about asset prices. The Fed was inflating with QE1, QE2. So we were going to see a run up of not only inflation oriented assets like commodities, especially gold, silver, oil, and which came right back up. Oil went right back up from $36 a barrel back right over 100. Gold prices, silver prices all recovered all the way to their highs of 2011. But most people didn't want to do that. They were predicting there's another crisis around the corner. We're going to be in for a crash. They were still in that mindset of what occurred between 2007 in 2009. So if we look at all of this and try to summarize here, all manias, all bubbles begin with a concept, an idea. And that idea eventually becomes an illusion. And what becomes rational behavior and investing turns into irrational behavior and speculation. And then you throw in leverage, which helps accelerate the process. And during this, you have what we call insiders and outsiders. The insiders are the smart money that says, you know what, this is crazy. I'm taking my profits. I'm exiting. They're the first people and the closest to the exit door. Hence, people like Ray Dalio at Bridgewater saying, we're dancing, but we're moving closer to the door. And then you have the outsiders, the people that don't see it coming, but can only imagine the fabulous wealth and speculative manias gather speed through expansion of money and credit. Think of tulip mania, fattened on personal credit. All manias are fueled by the expansion of money and credit. And one of the lessons that we can draw here, and Kindleberger talks about it in his book, Manias, Panics, and Crashes. And he says, you know, the advantage of having a central bank, a lender of last resort, like the Federal Reserve, they did stem the crisis and stopped what could have been another Great Depression. But as Kindleberger warns in his books, every recovery from a bursting bubble or financial crisis depends on how the crisis is handled. It could be solved by new innovation. It can be solved by pent-up demand, or it can be solved by prudent government policy. Imprudent government policy, as we saw during the Great Depression, turned what was an economic recession into a depression. And that's the problem that we have today. We have experts, and we have all heard this term before, the moral hazard. We're rescuing these mismanaged institutions who are leveraged to the hilt, or in many cases, individuals who are leveraged to the hilt. The central bank comes in, and the problem is, if you tell somebody, hey, you can go out and speculate, and if you make a lot of money, it's yours, but if you lose money, like the banks did, we'll bail you out. And that's the moral hazard. The problem is the federal government and the Fed think they know how to handle financial crises by simply throwing a bunch of money at it. And after the crisis over, they just come up, mop up the mess. Alan Greenspan was saying, well, we can't predict the crises, even though he made the irrational exuberant speech. But what we know how to do is once the crisis hits and the bubble bursts, well, we can come in and mop up everything by throwing money. And there's also a political dimension that comes in, and it's politicians deciding who was helped. The Fed and the government decided that Bear Stearns was worth bailing out. When it came to Lehman, they decided that there needed to be taught a lesson. The consequences were it steepened the financial crisis and led us to the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
Let's bring this back to something pragmatic now, looking towards the future. We had the internet tech stocks bubble in the 1990s, had real estate in the 2000s. Now, what you say is that we're forming another bubble. Okay, real estate's running. It's a little fevered right now, at least in some parts of the country. But if you look around, you don't seem to have a target area where that bubble seems to be focusing. So if we do have a bubble, like you're saying, where is it?
The bubble, in my estimation, it is like it's easy money. It's passive investing in the form of an index ETF or an index mutual fund. It's being driven by computers. No thought is given to what is bought or sold. It's the downfall of human psychology. Right now, it is estimated that the money that will be flowing into index ETFs and mutual funds will be $800 billion, up 60% from the previous year. And next year, it's estimated we will top over $1 trillion. Now, what happens when money goes into an index fund? It's not a portfolio manager that's saying, do I really want to buy Amazon at 260 times earnings? If the index weighting is 3%, 3%, let's say $100 million comes into an index fund, the manager of that fund and traders are automatically going to buy $3 million worth of Amazon. Doesn't matter what Amazon missed their earnings as they did this week by a wide margin. Doesn't matter that it's selling at 260 times earnings. Doesn't matter what its valuation is. It's just automatically done. It's mindless investing as dollars flow into index funds, fueling the rise of what we're seeing in these FANG stocks and other large cap stocks. The process becomes self-feeding. The more money that goes into these index funds, since the indexes are market cap weighted, they have to buy those market cap stocks. The more that they put money in those stocks, the larger the cap weighting becomes. As the index gets rebalanced, the index weight of that stock becomes larger and larger. And now what you have, after 9 years of a bull market and stock prices going up, everybody wants to get in and get rich and rise with the stock market. So the illusion that is coming in after the Trump presidency and the rally of the market that's up almost 24% since the election is we're going to get health reform. Obamacare is going to be repealed. Well, that failed this week. Now they're moving on to tax reform. And listen to my interview next Tuesday on the show, because we talk about the probabilities of what tax reform will look like. Even if it gets passed, it's going to be nowhere near what you're reading in the press. And then also infrastructure spending. None of these events are likely to take place. And as we've seen, John, the Republicans have been incapable of delivering. And at the same time, we have a large amount of leverage in the system. Whether you look at margin debt, whether you look at corporate debt, whether you look at derivatives, whether you look at credit outstanding, and let's not forget what's happened under our last two presidents. We began this century with $5 trillion in debt. And under the leadership of two presidents, beginning with Bush, Bush doubled the debt from 5 to 10 trillion, and Obama doubled the debt from 10 to 20 trillion. And I don't care, we've talked about this, it places a limitation on what the president is going to be able to do or what Congress is going to be able to do, because we have two factors now. Obama was lucky. He was able to double the national debt, and by the time he left office, the interest the government was paying on the debt was less than where it was with almost $10 trillion less in debt when he took office in 2009. So the government has debt. And that's why we're talking about tax reform. There are a number of provisions right now. They're going to raise taxes on IRAs. And when they talk about tax reform, hold on to your wallet, folks, because they are going to be raising taxes. The government needs more money. So right now, the illusion of the promises is helping to fuel this bubble. We have low interest rates globally, so it pays individuals to speculate, borrow, margin, and leverage. It's reinforcing the leverage in the system. And there's something else that's taking place here. As a result of the low interest rates, you have people in search for a yield. If you're an insurance company, a pension fund, and you have to earn 7% return, where are you going to get that money? And so that's why you've seen it in the various sectors in the S&P, where you're seeing tech, health, discretionary, industrials lead, but you're also seeing the utilities up double digits this year as investors search for yield. Where else are you going to get 3 or 4% or more? You're going to get that in a utility stock or maybe an energy stock, but you know it's going to be hard to get that if you're in a treasury at 2.3 or 2.4%.
Yeah, and you know, you're seeing it here too right now because you have consumer optimism up. Remember how long everybody sat on the sidelines after the market crash in 2008? Now, all of a sudden, consumer optimism up. The investors are enthralled with the market. It's going up every single week. We hear new records. But this phase of index funds right now reminds you very much, you know, where have we seen this before? Day traders back in the 1990s when all you had to do was come into work every day and play the changes in the market and everything was good. The problem is that the Fed is raising interest rates. They're talking about shrinking their balance sheet. And you know, Jim, as we look at this, eventually inflation is going to rise, and we know what happens then.
It's amazing, too, because if you're looking at an institution, the Federal Reserve, as we have commented here so many times, every recession and bear market was preceded by a Fed rate raising cycle, as we are now in. And the track record of the Fed having a soft landing, I can think of one in my investment career, which was in 1994 when Greenspan doubled the Fed funds rate from 3 to 6. But if you're looking at the Fed as a pilot of an airplane and they have a record of crash landing the airplane, how much confidence can you have longer term as an investor?
All right. Well, you're talking about a bubble, but there's one question that's been brewing in the back of my head during all of this thing. And that is, as investors, what do you do at different stages of the market? And more importantly, what are you doing right now?
I mean, right now we're doing exactly what Ray Dalio is talking about. We're watching the tea leaves. We have our own proprietary recession indicator. It is rising, but it fell precipitously with the election of Donald Trump. It was almost approaching 20 and it fell all the way down to 5. Now it's about 9.5. So we're watching the LEIs. We're watching credit spreads, which have narrowed, which is typical as you enter the final stage. But, you know, we're taking a somewhat defensive position. It's, you know, I've expressed this before. We're not 100% invested in stocks. And I gradually will see that percentage becoming smaller and smaller as we go forward, as prices go higher and higher. But, you know, right now we're still dancing. I mean, if you look at PE ratios, when you looked at the market in 1997, the PE ratios were out of the ordinary. We had never seen anything like this, probably going back to 1929. But nonetheless, the market went up in 1998, went up in 99, and finally until March of 2000 when it ended. And you saw the same thing happen in 2007. So we're, at least in our minds, we're about ready to enter the final phase of the bubble. As I mentioned, and that bubble is in this passive investing, $800 billion going into passive ETFs and mutual funds. 2018, they're projecting at the present rate, we will be over $1 trillion of going into these passive index funds. And what does that do? That means that these index funds do not pay attention to what they're buying and what they're paying. And that's why, for a brief moment this week, and you heard that with Jonathan Krinsky, Jeff Bezos, for a fleeting moment on Thursday, became the wealthiest man in the world, surpassing Bill Gates with his net worth almost $92 billion. But Amazon missed their earnings by a wide margin. But nonetheless, here's what the result of all this indexing is. You take a retailer like Amazon, which is selling at 259 times earnings. It has a market cap of $500 billion. And you take somebody like a Walmart, which has a PE of 18, a market cap of only $240 billion. And Amazon had sales of $160 billion estimated this year. Walmart will have sales of $500 billion. Walmart will make over $13 billion this year compared to Amazon of 3.8. And you look at these valuations, and you know, we did a show on this a number of months ago because we were looking at this and I was saying, who in their right mind is paying this? And I was trying to think of, as we look deeper and deeper and doing our own research, what was fueling it? So, you know, what rational investor would pay 260 times earnings for a company? But that's what happens When money pours into an index fund, they have to buy the stocks of the index no matter what the price is. So this is what we call mindless investing, which is the hallmark of every asset bubble. Individuals, advisors, institutions are swept up. And what you better be doing right now is, as Ray Dalio says, is keeping an eye on the exit door, because just as indexing is driving up the prices of these companies in stocks, remember, when you go into a bear market, it's the reverse of that. When the stampede begins, and I think this is something often lost in the early years when the market recovery began, because between the peak of September 2007 in the bottom of March of 2009, the S&P lost 58% of its value. So if you were in an index fund and you were invested, you lost 60% of your values. And most investors won't see it. They won't understand the displacement and the shock event that eventually will create that unease. And when the full stampede begins and accelerates, remember in bear markets, and just if you are an investor, just pull up a chart of the S&P and take a look at how rapid the fall was and how quickly in the shorter period of time. Think of a bull market as an escalator. Think of a bear market as a cliff, because it happens faster, quicker, and steeper versus the gradual rise that you see in a bull market. And that's what lulls into people in the mania in the final phase, because it's going up every single year. And people tend to look at a trend in place and think it'll remain a trend in place for a long period of time.
It would seem that a lot of this, a lot of investing, as a matter of fact, but this in particular all boils down to almost what you call the psychology of crowds. There was a book that was written almost a century ago on that one. But Minsky said, you know, we've seen this cycle over and over and over again. And so it is really driven by psychology rather than by any connection to reality.
Yeah. And what tends to happen with human psychology, picture yourself, you're in Vegas, you're winning at the roulette table or the blackjack table, and the chips are piling up in your favor. The important point is to take some capital off and start being proactive in risk management, because we don't know what the displacement event is going to be. It's always different in every single bursting of the bubble. You got the clue with Bear Stearns, but the big one was Lehman Brothers. And then the other one was basically Greenspan just kept ratcheting and ratcheting and ratcheting interest rates up to the point where the bubble finally burst in 2000, when the NASDAQ peaked, but it went up another 20% after going up 70% in 1999. And you're seeing it now. Money is pouring in. It's driving up these prices. And, you know, that's basically how all of this ends. And remember, what is fueling it is credit. And credit is cheap. And we're seeing it right now with the narrowing of credit spreads. In other words, if you were investing in high-risk bonds, whether they're junk bonds or emerging debt, you are not being compensated for taking the risk. And as we have seen in every single crisis, it is that credit, it is that leverage, it is that margin that eventually brings this to end. And that's what accelerates the stampede. Is margin debt is called, people are forced to sell, financial institutions that are heavily leveraged are eventually going bankrupt. And that's how every cycle always ends.
Leverage debt. Bottom line, it's borrowing to the hilt. And I hate to tell you this, but it's a bankrupt business model. It won't work. It's systemic, malignant, and it's global. Like cancer. It's a disease, and we gotta fight back. How are we gonna do that? How are we gonna leverage that disease back in our favor?
The wise voice in this case of Michael Douglas in Wall Street 2, Money Never Sleeps. And it seems, Jim, we've seen this before. We're going to see it again, you know, and what the wise investor can do is avoid getting caught on the trap.
Absolutely. Once again, it's like that gambler in Vegas. When you see the chips piling up, you always want to think about taking some of those chips off. So at the end of the day, you walk away with some chips in your pocket. and not empty pockets.
And so next week, we'll discuss the fact that the market has totally collapsed and the bubble has burst, just like Jim predicted. It's going to happen next week, Tuesday, I would think. Right, Jim? That's when it's all going to go.
Yeah, Tuesday at 12:34 p.m.
Probably so. No, in reality, what are we looking forward to in the weeks to come?
Let me see. We're still going through earnings season. The Fed meeting, it was basically nothing. And we have Jackson Hole coming up in August. That's the Fed conclave. I'm sure everybody is going to be anxious to see. Will Yellen tip her hat and say that the Fed begins shrinking its balance sheet, which is another form of tightening, as soon as September and October, which is what the bets are being made right now, that they will go at the end of the third quarter or the beginning of the fourth. They'll shrink their balance sheet and the possibility of one more rate hike coming in December at the end of the year. It'll be interesting. Watch the inflation numbers and watch the price of oil as we go forward, as Saudi Arabia pulls back on its shipments of oil to the U.S. as those inventories are drawn down, although we do have the shoulder months. So a lot of stuff to talk about here in the weeks ahead, and also a special Financial Sense News Hour as we take our annual August recess. We've got some great, great interviews coming up that you're going to enjoy. So a lot of things coming up in the weeks ahead. In the meantime, on behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.